Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexaderm and Simply Safe. You know, we talk about, you know, what's a big deal and what's not a big deal. We got to play a game, you know, big deal, not a big deal. The last 12 hours feels like it has had a big deal about every hour. We're kind of having this sort of news cycle in one day that used to take months to have. We've asked David Priest, who is the CFO of Lawfare, to come on and sort this out. And David, first of all, happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Is it only Friday?
It is.
It feels like it's next Friday already.
Well, it's only October 2019.
Yeah.
So
it's a big deal. You're right.
Yeah.
This is a big week. This is a big day. And at the time of our recording, it's been a big few hours, a lot to get into.
Well, I want to talk about your piece in The Washington Post today that the Senate is likelier to remove Trump after impeachment than you think, which would be than I think, because you want to challenge conventional wisdom. I am conventional wisdom. So we'll see whether you can persuade me on all of this.
Well, you know as well as I do that the writers don't write the headlines. But in this case, the headline that they put on it pretty accurately represents the article. The Senate is likelier to remove Trump after impeachment than you think. The only thing I would have changed is I would have written the Senate is likelier to remove Trump after impeachment than Charlie Sykes.
Well, that's true. So, you know, this morning when I sat down to write the newsletter, and by the way, if you're listening, we have a suite of newsletters at The Bulwark, and you really ought to subscribe. I have my morning shots. JVL, Jonathan Last has the triad in the middle of the day, and Jim Swift has a newsletter near the end of the day. And I sat down and I said, you know, things have gotten a lot worse in the last 24 hours for a bunch of folks. It's gotten a lot worse for Donald Trump. It's gotten a lot worse for Rudy Giuliani. It's gotten a lot worse for Lindsey Graham. It's gotten a lot worse for people like Cory Gardner. I mean, just going through, it's almost, where do you start on all of this? And even as we are speaking, the Ukrainian ambassador, the former Ukrainian ambassador, Maria Yovanovitch, is testifying in front of Congress that the State Department's number two official informed her that even though she did nothing wrong, that President Trump had lost confidence in her and that, you know, the department had been under significant pressure to sack her since mid-2018. And so the fallout from that is continuing. The fallout from the arrest of two of Rudy Giuliani's cronies who were knee-deep in influence peddling involving Ukraine in this effort to oust the ambassador of the Ukraine. Then, of course, you have the Washington Post story about, you know, the other officials who are saying that they were, you know, alarmed by the way the White House was handling Ukraine in the arms sales, and certainly suggesting that John Bolton was not on board at all. You have on Friday morning the D.C. Circuit ruling ruling that in fact Trump is going to have to turn over certain financial records to the House of Representatives. That, of course, can be appealed. I don't know where else we go here. Lindsey Graham is pranked by some Russians, so he's caught on tape basically sucking up to the Turks. Telling them that those Kurds are a threat. So, you know, and we're still in the week where Turkey is still moving into Syria. David, I noticed on Twitter that you had a very strong reaction to the betrayal of the Kurds. As leaving it aside from all the other stuff that happens, it struck me that did feel different, and the reaction among Republicans felt different. I mean, you had a gut reaction, didn't you?
It did. I was frankly disgusted. And I know people have been throwing around terms, and it's hard as a writer and maybe as a podcaster, it's hard to come up with new terms to express disappointment that has a even darker side to it. But I was physically nauseated by the reports that were coming out. I believe David Ignatius broke some of the details first, that the Turkish attack could be coordinated with Russians, and this was known. And I didn't feel figuratively sick. I felt physically nauseated. It was beyond some other things, and perhaps matching a few other things that we've seen. But it was just a moment when I felt, oh, these are literally lives that will be ended because of the president's impulsive nature, his narcissistic attitude. And many of his policies we laugh about, we joke about, we talk about, this is bad, this isn't the policy we would want, or this isn't true to constitutional principles. Some of that is in the abstract. Kurds who supported the United States, who fought our fight for us in many ways, Kurds dying because the president was influenced on the most recent phone call, that is sick. And that really got to me.
And the blowback was so intense that there was a moment when I thought that he might walk it back. But then yesterday, you saw the United States teaming up with Russia to stop the Security Council from condemning the Turkish invasion. The White House visit by Erdogan apparently is still on, isn't it?
I have not heard that it's off.
Yeah.
It's case number 1000 of this, but it's a case where I immediately go to some paragons. I go to Ronald Reagan, I go to George H.W. Bush, and I say, they may not be rolling in their graves, but this is the kind of thing that you simply can't imagine that they would have made a similar choice and done it in the same way. Yes, the president has the right to execute certain military deployments. I don't think this is an impeachable offense on the face of constitutional power. But in terms of the way he went about doing it, how he did it, why he did it, it's disgusting.
Well, and you could see that it rattled some of his longtime supporters, including
Right on.
evangelical Christians, who have to ask themselves, okay, you're appalled by this. Are you really down? Did you really sign up for 5 more years of this? Now, I had a conversation with a really smart guy yesterday, and it was an off-the-record conversation, so I won't name him. And what we were discussing was whether this actually made a difference, whether or not this was one of those cases where the average disconnected American is going, eh, Sunni, Shia, Kurds, let them just kill each other. We don't just get out of there. We don't care. Or whether this is different, whether or not the sense that we had betrayed our friends would cut through.
Right.
And normally I
It's
go with the more cynical analysis, but I just have a sense listening to, seeing your reaction, watching the reaction of some of my friends, including my wife, to all of this, that the this thing of the betrayal of our friends, and when we start to see the pictures, I think, coming out of Syria, I
Right.
think this will cut through. I think this won't be just a, hey, they're just a bunch of people in the Middle East killing each other.
You've got something there. The rank betrayal, the fact that this is, it's almost as clear as the Ukraine scandal in terms of the ability to boil it down to one or two sentences. It doesn't require a 448-page Mueller report or even a multi-episode podcast to explain the report. This is something that in a sentence or two, anybody can understand why this is just wrong. That cuts through. Now, the other side of it, I think, is a valid point, which is, we are talking about Kurds. And I would bet, even after everything we've been through in recent American history, if you were to poll 1,000 Americans and ask them about the Kurds, you would still have a very substantial percentage, maybe a majority, who say, who? So I don't think it's really about the Kurds themselves. I think it's about the obvious betrayal that comes up. For me, the more interesting part was that you actually had Republicans speaking out against the president in relatively harsh terms compared to their just amazing ability to roll over to Donald Trump in the last couple of years. But you had many Republicans speaking up saying, this is absolutely wrong. The president should not do this. And the president didn't really push back. Instead, he said he disagreed, but he respected their right to disagree. I'm not sure we've ever heard it phrased that way from the president before. And what does that do? That actually could give a dose of courage to a few senators who could become very important in the coming months.
Yeah, and then of course we have this story, the Rudy Giuliani story, which is actually also a Donald Trump story. These two Russians who were arrested yesterday, and this is from the New York Times. The federal prosecutors unsealed charges on Thursday against two men who have aided President Trump's efforts to gather damaging information in Ukraine about his political opponents. It revealed new details about the push to pressure Ukraine, a campaign encouraged by Mr. Trump, led by his private lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and assisted by obscure figures like Mr. Parnas and Mr. Fruman. I mean, the fact that these indictments were issued by a Trump-appointed U.S. attorney is really going to complicate the attempts to just brush this all off.
It takes away an easy counterargument for the president, and it also opens up an area of investigation that could go south fast. I imagine, again, in terms of what the American people can understand, you have the Ukraine scandal, which seems to have resonated with many people. You have Rudy Giuliani at the middle of it. You have these two people who apparently are trying to get out of Dodge quickly right after they have lunch with Rudy Giuliani, and then sealed indictments suddenly have to be unsealed and they're arrested as they try to flee with one-way tickets.
There's
a lot that wasn't in the complaint, and we need more details about exactly what their involvement was with the dig up dirt on the Bidens exercise. But just on first blush, it really doesn't look good.
No. Also, it just highlights how Rudy has fallen into his own swamp of corruption. And I mean, you know, I think people have sort of realized that it's going to end badly for the man that we once revered as America's mayor. And it could probably be worse. And by the way, in my list of big things that have happened in the last 24 hours, I left out, and this is a sign maybe how numbed and normalized everything's become, the president's rally up in Minneapolis, where he decided to turn this into where to even start, you know, pretending, you know, mimicking the orgasm of Peter Strzok. I don't know whether that was going on. The attacks on Somalis by name. There's nothing subtle about the president, you know, deciding that he is going to make Ilhan Omar, who I disagree with her on a lot of stuff. I think she deserves lots of criticism, but you can see what he's doing, especially when he is going after this group of Somali refugees in Minneapolis. The card that he is playing, it is so raw. It is so, you know, beyond, you know, dog whistle here. And yet it's probably story number, 15 of the day.
My brain keeps telling me, and this is, again, another case of this, but my brain keeps telling me that this is a strategy that the president is calculating, that if he can rile up the base and he can put Minnesota into play in 2020, that makes up for the fact that he's going to lose the votes of any Somali Americans who would still vote for him. That's what my brain says. Mm-hmm. And then something inside of me rises up and basically slaps the brain down and says, you idiot, this isn't about calculated political strategy. I go back to George Conway's tour de force article recently about Donald Trump and his decision making. Donald Trump wasn't calculating the percentage of his base. He was in front of a crowd. The more outrageous things he says, the better the crowd reacts. That's his adrenaline. It feeds his narcissism. I don't think this was a political strategy. I think this was Donald Trump loving being at his rallies and getting people to cheer the most outrageous thing he can say or do.
Well, let me square that circle, because I'm reluctant to give him credit for having these grand strategies. On the other hand, there is a method to his madness, and I think it's the reptilian cunning of the guy who understands what does it take to rile up his base, and he is playing these really unsubtle racial cards, and I really am reluctant to play that card myself. But there's no question about it that what he is doing here, that he has gone from making illegal immigrants as the threat and the enemy to making refugees, which is something new. It is very, very different. And specifically, spending a good deal of time and effort focusing on black refugees, and that he thinks this will rile up his base tells you something about what he thinks about his base and what his base cares about and what they don't care about. Okay, so here's the other thing. The whistleblower, we heard this week that there's a second whistleblower. There's ongoing negotiations for the first whistleblower. There is a very clear concerted campaign on the part of Trump world and their allies in the media to discredit the whistleblower. This is very much part of their playbook. They're not pretending that this is not central. I don't really see what that does, since the whistleblower's identity is not as important as whether or not the information the whistleblower put forward turns out to be true, which it does. But did you see this latest report that says that the whistleblower, you know, was caught having this professional relationship with one of the Democratic candidates, turns out to be Joe Biden?
Oh, I saw this. This was in the, I hate to give it any credence by even identifying it, but it's worth reading. Both as
Well, this is in the
potential
Washington
journalism.
Examiner, right?
Yeah,
I
it's in the
mean, yeah,
Washington
okay.
Examiner, and it came out, I believe, on October 10th, saying that this whistleblower, the first whistleblower, would have been working with Joe Biden when he was vice president, as if that somehow cheapened the actual facts of the case. Well, let me take it up a level, Charlie. What this points to is either a fundamental misunderstanding of what the US government bureaucracy does, or it is a shameless, disingenuous attempt to literally blame someone for doing their job that the American taxpayer pays them to do. I would like to think that it's just ignorance, but this is so bad and so poorly done that I think it reflects an active attempt to misrepresent the facts. If you're saying that someone in the United States national security establishment, whose job, especially in the intelligence community, is to try to assess what's going on in an uncertain world, present that information to policymakers from the lowliest desk officer at the State Department to the President of the United States, their job is to present that as objectively and as neutrally as possible. When I briefed people in the White House, when I briefed people in cabinet secretaries and undersecretaries and everyone else, of course I was aware of what political party they were in, but I didn't care. I didn't give a shit what political party they were in because I was doing my job, which is to say they are the Secretary of State or they are the National Security Advisor. I owe them for my salary from the US taxpayer. I owe them my best assessment of what's going on in the world. What they do with it in terms of policy,
Sure.
well, that's up to them and ultimately up to the people of the United States at the next election.
So he was
But that's
doing it. He was
not
just doing his
my
job. He was just doing his
he
job.
or she was doing their job. And if they did not do that, think about the logical extension of this ridiculous argument. The logical extension is people within the bureaucracy should be picking whom they serve by briefing, whom they give information to, whom they interact with, as bureaucracies have done through all of government, based on whether they agree with certain political positions they hold. That is corrosive to the entire idea of federal government, and no previous president would ever want that as a principle. In fact, if somebody came to them and told them, you know, I'm going to brief this differently to your boss because they're a political appointee, they at least would be pulled off of that account and maybe lose their job because that is antithetical to the idea of the intelligence community and it's antithetical to good government.
I also think that the attack on the whistleblower is from an old playbook that's about to become very outdated. I get a sense, tell me what you think, that I feel that there's a critical mass forming right now of people who are willing to come forward, and I think that the Ukrainian ambassador's testimony is certainly an indication of that she's willing to come forward. More people, more voices. More reports. We don't know how many other whistleblowers there are going to be, how many people in the national security establishment are going to step forward and say things. But once you have that critical mass, it becomes much more difficult for the usual suspects to simply, pick them off as well. It turns out they're just a bunch of, liberal Democrats.
And this is another one of those cases where we can't even keep up with the news
Right.
because, again, as we're going into the recording of this, the Daily Beast is reporting a story from Hill sources that not only the first whistleblower who is already in train, not only the second one that has been discussed, but according to two congressional sources, there are multiple other whistleblowers who are investigating whether they can and how to come forward to talk about wrongdoing they've seen. I'm not sure that this is a flood. Some whistleblowers are, let me put it this way, all whistleblowers are not created equal.
Right.
Some people have a moral compass where they will feign outrage or even feel outrage at even the slightest offense and treat it like it's a resigning issue. Most people aren't, especially within the national security bureaucracy. People tolerate a whole lot. And if you see whistleblowers coming out on this and other issues, I'm not sure there's enough time and enough committee staff to be investigating all the wrongdoing that they could be talking about.
Well, that's another one of the angles I want to get into, which is Nancy Pelosi has you know, has changed her mind on impeachment is, you know, has been apparently pursuing the narrow impeachment as opposed to broader. And all of the stuff coming out sort of does challenge all of that. Speaking of which, going back to that Minneapolis rally last night, you saw that Eric Trump was leading the crowd at one point in the lock him up, going after Joe Biden, lock him up chants. So extra points for the originality and creativity of that, you know, from the Trumps. Although if I'm the Trumps, I don't think that I want to make lock them up the theme just because it worked in 2016. It sort of feels and sounds different in 2020, doesn't it?
You know, playing your greatest hits album over and over again actually is a strategy. Sometimes there's some catchy hits on a greatest hits album. But when you're replaying the greatest hits album in today's world of, let's say, New Kids on the Block from the late 80s and early 90s, those hits ain't going to play as well. And this is a shorter time frame. And even 2 years ago, yes, the people in that arena may have loved the lock him up. It gives them that shot of adrenaline. But I guarantee you, whether it's that issue, whether it's the Kurds, whether it's other overreach by the president, you already saw it, Charlie. You had a GOP congressman yesterday come out and say on the Kurdish issue, this was so egregious. Not only does he not support the action, which is what most people on the Hill said, but this congressman came out and said, I no longer support Donald Trump. Now, that is a congressman, that is a representative, not a senator. But when you start to have people come out and not only say, I don't support the president's actions, because some of these are just so stupid, but I actually can't support the president anymore, you start to see momentum shift because of the serial nature of these decisions.
Yeah, and that I think is the key. And I'm looking at the Washington Post report. You know, Ukraine scandal entangles a widening cast of previously obscure characters. We're going to get to know all of them. It does feel different. And of course, this is, you know, we're going to say this again, that, you know, this feels different than the Mueller investigation, because that went on for a very long time. And in retrospect, was asymmetrical because it was secret. We didn't know what was going on. So you did have the ability of the White House to, you know, frame the issue, and the Mueller folks, because of their integrity and because of the rules, did not fire back, didn't make the case. That's certainly not the case now. Okay, so let's get to this here.
Yeah.
The Senate is likelier to remove Trump after impeachment than you think. This is a piece that you wrote in the Washington Post, and it draws on a lot of history. And I'm going to go into this thinking that you are trying to sell me a unicorn, David Priest. Okay, so let's do this, but let's hear a word from our sponsors first. Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security, maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why SimpliSafe is my top choice. SimpliSafe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. SimpliSafe has won a ton of awards, from CNET to the New York Times Wire Cutter, and prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear, so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word Bulwark. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use code Bulwark at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com. Okay, we are back with David Priest, who's the Chief Operating Officer at the Lawfare Institute. You're a visiting fellow at the National Security Institute at George Mason, a former CIA intelligence officer, and you've written a book on how to get rid of a president, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives, which now has become a kind of a handbook. So you think that it's likelier, the Senate is likelier to remove Trump after impeachment than you think. Now, that requires 20 senators doing something that they have not even come close to doing in the past. So convince me that you're not trying to sell me a used unicorn here.
Sure. The two arguments that come up most often when people say the Senate will never convict the president if he's impeached, or it is impossible. And both of those are out there. In fact, I may have said some of those in the past. The two arguments that come up most often are the historical argument and the current political argument. So let's hit the history first, because that's easier to dismiss. The historical argument is, well, we have had impeachments before. We've had Andrew Johnson impeached and we've had Bill Clinton impeached. In both cases, the Senate failed to convict. And guess what? In the Andrew Johnson case, I mean, that's ancient history now, but we still had the same rules in effect for how the trial works. The trial went to the Senate. The Republicans who were opposed to Andrew Johnson had more than a two-thirds majority. They were actually primed to kick him out of office. And yet they still held back and did not kick him out of office. That's a pretty strong case for an actual right now Republican-controlled Senate never convicting the president. But it overlooks a crucial difference between the two impeachments. The impeachment of Andrew Johnson rested on at least a couple of things that were unlike what we're seeing now. In one case, the main spur for his impeachment moving forward was that he violated a law that itself was on shaky ground and was later found unconstitutional. And some senators recognized that this was, to use a phrase, a trumped-up charge in some ways. Some of the other articles against Johnson included things like saying he was out in public saying mean things about Congress. And yeah, that was a little bit more of a norm then than it certainly is now, but it was still well short of warranting ejecting somebody from the White House. So let's look at the more recent case historically, and that's Bill Clinton. We all remember it. What happened in Bill Clinton's case? Well, guess what? He was impeached. Even many Democrats were saying what he did was wrong. This is perjury. This is obstruction of justice. He shouldn't have done it. But guess what? He did it in order to cover up a personal affair, and it was not a sign of inherent, repeated, unfit activity. It was an aberration, and a huge one, and a bad one. But it was not the same as Donald Trump, where he is doing the same things over and over again. It feels like we're on repeat because of his implication of the constitutional fabric itself. So we can't really look at history and say that the case has been proven that a president can never be removed from office, because both cases had factors that were not true in today's world. But I take your point, which is to say, screw history. Let's just look at the actual math in the U.S. Senate. And guess what? We need 20 Republican senators out of 53, 20 out of 53, to suddenly say, yep, I'm going to vote against a president nominally of my own party.
To remove him.
I mean, to get him out of office. Now, you know, because you talk to some of them, and I know, and certainly Jeff Flake knows even more than we do, where the senators actually stand. Would they rather have Mike Pence as president or Donald Trump as president? Very clearly, they'd rather have Mike Pence as president, even a damaged, limping one going into the campaign, because they know they can't trust Donald Trump. Jeff Flake said last month at the Texas Tribune Festival, he said, you know what? I know that 35 of my former colleagues in private would vote to remove the president. Now, there's a big difference between a private vote and a public vote, and the trial in the Senate is not a private vote. But political momentum can change quickly. And guess what? You had Republicans this week, some of them for the first time in 2 years, coming out guns blazing against the president, saying what he's doing is very, very wrong. It was not about the Mueller report. Except for a couple of cases, it wasn't even about the Ukraine debacle. It was about the Kurds. But you still had senators publicly saying, Donald Trump is wrong. This is horrible. We're going to do everything we can to stop this. And guess what? The president did not anger tweet at all of them and get a reaction from their constituents saying, how dare you do this? In fact, I have seen no sign.
And there has been none, right?
Constituents are angry at any of these Republican senators in very red states, in some cases, for saying something against the president. Well, that's a wake-up call for them now, isn't it? They realize that maybe, just maybe, we're better off without the president because he can't force me to commit political suicide in this way.
Well, let me give you an alternative interpretation of that, which is the compartmentalization, which is that they know that they can criticize the president on policy because that's not an existential threat to Donald Trump. That there's a real distinction between criticizing the president on a personal thing, on something like Ukraine or asking China or any of these other things, which is going to earn them the tweet storm and the blowback from the base. But criticizing him on a specific policy because this is not about policy, because the president really doesn't give a shit about policy, is kind of a free shot. So that you have guys like Lindsey Graham, who have been as strong as, at least when he's not thinking that he's talking on a private phone call with the Turkish defense minister, criticizing Trump in the strongest possible language. Mitch McConnell's statement was really barbed and strong, and yet they can still go all in opposing impeachment. That they don't, that in fact, one doesn't, because the compartmentalization is so hermetically sealed that one thing does not leak over into the other thing.
I think that is still more likely than not. And I think you will certainly have, even in the most egregious of cases, let's say that we find out even more, and the president becomes even more unhinged, you still probably will have 20 or 30 senators in almost any case who say, you know what, I've gone too far. I can't see my way out of this. I have to vote to acquit Donald Trump. Now, that goes against one other historical example, which was Richard Nixon. I mean, Richard Nixon had done some bad things, but some of them weren't as bad as what we've seen with Donald Trump. And yet you had Barry Goldwater and his colleagues go to the White House and tell Richard Nixon, you wouldn't even have 15 senators voting for you. 15 senators for the icon of the Republican Party for decades. So don't tell me it can't happen.
Well, but two things.
Because people don't feel the same way about Donald Trump as they do about Nixon, in large part because Richard Nixon still had great influence within the party. Donald Trump may have Trumpified a lot of the Republican Party, but he's not going to be around forever. And once he's out of the picture, which could be a few years, maybe 5 or 10 years, but once he's out of the political and social picture, I think that there is a strong chance of a reset. And do these Republicans really want to wage everything on this aberration within the Republican Party? I don't buy it for every senator in the Republican Party, maybe for a few, but you only need 20 out of 53. And we know for a fact that some of them would really love to get rid of Donald Trump.
They would. But going back to Richard Nixon, several things are different there, though. Richard Nixon's public approval rating was about 25%. He did not have, and even among Republicans, there were a lot of Republicans who had bailed on him. Donald Trump has terrible approval ratings. It's higher than Nixon had, and he does have this 80-90% approval rating among Republicans. And number two, he has a media and a moral universe in which people will say, even if he did order the break-in at Watergate, even if he did order the IRS to do it, it's okay, and the real story is, what was Larry O'Brien hiding in those file cabinets? Why were those file cabinets in the Watergate locked? Well, why not look at the IRS records if you have nothing to hide? So part of it is that in Richard Nixon, was functioning in a functioning moral universe where we had standards where if this happened, there would be these consequences. And I think this is the point that George Will makes. The scary thing about Donald Trump is that that moral universe and that moral, that universe of accountability may no longer apply, because he may be caught doing things that 5 minutes ago we would have thought would be absolutely unacceptable or a felony. And yet there will be a portion of the electorate that has tremendous weight among Republicans who are going to say, yeah, we're okay with that.
I think you're right. And I think that is...
I hope you're right.
Well, I think you're right up to this point, and I think you are likely to be right in the future, but it is not as certain as it was. I mean, fear of a Trump tweet has kept most GOP senators in line for a long time, but there are some key differences. I mean, you do have a presidential approval rating that is usually sitting in the high 30s, very low 40s, and it hasn't gone outside that very narrow band. You do have a majority of the American people now supporting impeachment. Two different polls in the last 2 days have shown it at 51 and 52% respectively. One of them, even among Republicans, when asked, it was up to 18% of people who still self-identify as Republican. And you know, you're taking out a lot of people that still feel true to what used to be Republican principles who are no longer participating in those polls as Republicans. But 18% of people who still self-identify as Republican say, yeah, he probably should be removed for this. That's a huge number, because that's not insignificant for the senators who are looking not just at their own ethics, but are looking at the landscape for either their reelection or their place in history and saying, huh, wait a minute. I have almost 20% as of today. In a week, who knows what it'll be, but I have almost 20% of a largely Trumpified party saying that he should be removed. Maybe I'm fearing Trump tweets a little too much. Maybe he's actually the emperor who has no clothes. And once everybody sees that it can be done, it will be a tidal wave. Now, I'm still not predicting that will happen, but I'm saying people who say it's impossible and can never happen are totally missing the idea that momentum can pick up quickly and what looked impossible becomes inevitable.
Right. I think momentum is the key thing here, is that once you have what was the analogy? I think it was in a Washington Post story that somebody said it was like the zebra who was picked off. And if you're one zebra can be picked off by the predatory lion. The question, what happens if there's 8, 9, 10? You know, does it become momentum? So would that require, though, a continuing momentum of new evidence or new bad behavior from the president? Because the argument that a lot of the Democrats are making is that we have enough evidence right now to move for an expeditious impeachment. On the other hand, it does seem like the pace is here. Is there some accumulation of weight that would, you know, the drip, 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 and it just becomes too overwhelming? Does there have to be a smoking gun that changes the political dynamic?
No, I mean, what's a smoking gun?
I guess
the whole analogy of a smoking gun is when, you know, you don't know who fired the shot, and the best evidence you have is a smoking gun. When people actually watch the president pull the trigger in his tweets or in his live press conferences, the smoking gun becomes irrelevant. You have the eyewitnesses of 300 million Americans who saw what happened. The issue here, the drip, 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 in a normal case, is seen as steadily eroding and eventually wears down the situation. Donald Trump has managed something which is quite the opposite, which is we become so desensitized to his violation of norms. We become so used to the fact that Donald Trump is going to be different than other presidents, and frankly, some people like it, that we've priced that in. We've priced in. I think you and I both believe that within the next week, perhaps within the next day, there will be something that drops that we put our head in our hands and say, holy crap, I can't believe that also happened. We just expect that to happen at this point. In fact, the opposite is more true in a Trumpified world, which is momentum should move quickly. And you saw the impeachment numbers moving up in the last few weeks, not because of people reading every page of the Mueller report and digesting it and adding to it these additional things. It was Ukraine. It was the fact that the president did something so blatant that was so wrong that people said, yeah, we impeach and remove him for that. Let's do it. Wow. Now, that's a lesson for Nancy Pelosi. If she wants to move forward, I think she's gotten rid of the idea that she apparently had months ago of, let's do these hearings, let's build up a mountain of evidence, and then if we're going to hold a vote, let's do it during the election season of 2020 to hit Trump when it's most important so we can win the election. I don't think that's where she is, and frankly, I don't think that's where the majority of her caucus is now. I think they're thinking, wait a minute, this has created such a momentum. We need to move quickly, because if we don't, then we are seen as weak, and it not only enables unconstitutional behavior, but it also tells the voters they can't rely on us to do the right thing, even when we have the majority to impeach. I think those are powerful reasons for this to move forward quickly based on what we already know.
Let me bounce something else off you, because, you know, sometimes we get too deep into the weeds. And we all of us who talk about this and deal with this on a regular basis, and we need to step back and think about, you know, what are the overarching themes? You know, in 2016, the overarching theme was people wanted absolute change. They were fed up. They wanted to burn it down. Right. There are, you know, you and I were talking about the reaction to Syria. Trump's gut tells him it's going to be about ending, you know, getting out of endless wars. I think it might be about betrayal. Very simple concept. Mm-hmm. 2016 strikes me as a campaign that's going to be decided by exhaustion, by the number of voters who are just exhausted. That even with the I'm one of those who was deeply concerned that the Democrats are going to blow this, that they're that they are going to throw this away, and you know. They'll have enough town hall meetings where they sneer at enough, you know, average Americans that people go, okay, you know, Trump's a total dumpster fire, but at least he's better than blank. I'm in that camp. On the other hand, I just think, I wonder how many Americans are just looking at this now and going, can I take another 4 years of this? Can I make another 5 years of this? And then in October and November, they may hate, given the kind of campaign it's going to be, they may hate both of the candidates. Both of them may be toxic, and they're going to go, okay, but I just can't imagine 4 more years of Trump.
I want to believe you. And I think there's a societal cultural shift that works against us on that, which is we feel that way and we project that onto others, which is, do you really want to wake up every morning feeling this way? Do you want every day to be turning on the news and knowing that you're going to have something that's going to make you feel stressed? In a positive or a negative way. And I say positive because guess what? There's a lot of adrenaline junkies out there who actually like this.
It's part of the reality dopamine culture,
right? It's about, oh, this is entertainment. This is fun. People who didn't tune into politics strongly now are saying, oh, what's he going to do next? What's on the next episode of the Trump presidency? And we're watching it live. We can't discount the fact that there's a lot of people out there who really do enjoy that. Just look at his rallies. Are they representative of the whole American public? Of course they're not, but they give him what he wants and they do represent that dark undercurrent to it. I have a feeling that the exhaustion factor is actually not going to help that much because there is that countervailing trend. Plus, I'm sick of people saying, and I probably will start attacking people who say, every re-election bid is a referendum on the existing president. Mm-hmm. That is garbage.
You don't think so?
Okay. An election is always a contest between two people. You want to tell me that there weren't significant amounts of people voting against Hillary Clinton? Why won't there be significant numbers of people voting against Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or whomever ends up being, regardless of the fact that they're exhausted by Donald Trump, that they're horrified by the selling out of national security for personal interests, regardless of the fact that they see betrayal of some allies who have died for us, so our sons and daughters didn't have to. Despite all that, people vote against candidates. It's not just a referendum on the current administration. And honestly, if Democrats let their guard down and forget that, then they're going to deserve what they get.
Well, I do tend to agree with that as well. And because I hear from those voters all the time, the ones who will not disagree with anything we've said about Donald Trump, but when it comes down to it, they look at Elizabeth Warren, they look at Bernie Sanders, less so at Bernie Sanders anymore since he seems to be fading, and go, yeah, I can't take this. This is not what I signed up for. And I have to say that I have not been impressed with the way that Joe Biden has handled this over the last 2 weeks. He gave a very strong speech the other day, but
other than that, he's been absent.
Yeah, you know, there's like a 2-week lag. And the one thing that, you know, in the modern era, you can't have a 2-week lag. You can't take 2 weeks to make your decision. And, you know, again, I'm not trying to be insulting, but, you know, if you lose a step in this kind of a news cycle, that can be fatal. And I know there are a lot of folks on the Democratic side who may be very, very, very sympathetic to him, who are really concerned about that, who are really concerned about his ability to make these kinds of decisions and to push back, because he will eventually get around to doing it, but the eventually is what is potentially fatal.
Absolutely. And for somebody who has a reputation of saying what's on his mind, you know, gaffe-prone Joe Biden, of just saying what's out there, ironically, his rapid response is pretty poor in the modern era, right? He's not getting out there after these issues. And it may be a conscious strategy of, we're the front runner. We look like the sane one compared to some of the policies that are being pushed by others. So let's not say or do anything that rocks the base that we have locked in. Well, that doesn't work in an era where everybody else is getting primetime coverage, pushing back against just about everything not only this president does, but pushing forward on issues that a significant percentage of the Democratic base wants to hear. The lack of a rapid response doesn't actually help preserve that base. It actually makes him look weak and indecisive, which just isn't going to work in a crowded primary.
And he's not really the front runner anymore. I mean, he really is. I mean, I think that, you know, as of right now, I think that the fairest analysis is that this election is Elizabeth Warren's to lose, and whether or not she can pivot back toward the center, what's going to tell us a lot. David Priest, thank you so much. I appreciate it again, and for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast.
Absolutely.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by Plexaderm and SimpliSafe. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back. Well, actually, we're going to be back over the weekend with a special podcast, and we'll do this all over again.